Welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. My name is Guy McPherson. My mission is to help trauma therapists be their incredible selves, to be human, to be real, not just a clinician. I'm a big believer in who we are is more important than what we know. And this requires cultivating authenticity, genuineness, and vulnerability. And that requires intention. You can learn more about my courses and workshops by going to thetraumatherapistproject.com. That's thetraumatherapistproject.com. Let's get started. So 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. All right, folks, welcome back to the podcast. Very excited to have as my guest today, Dr. Ken Benow. Ken, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So Ken is a licensed clinical psychologist since 1990 with private practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. His practice includes individual, couple, and family therapy, clinical consultation, and professional training. For over 40 years, Dr. Benow has worked with children and adults with various learning and developmental differences in inpatient, outpatient, and school settings. He has a particular interest in and expertise in shame and pride-informed psychotherapy with survivors of relational trauma, working from an integrative perspective that incorporates psychodynamic, experiential, and somatic approaches, among others. Dr. Benow's well-received book, Shame, Pride, and Relational Trauma, Concepts in Psychotherapy, was published in March 2022. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So before we get going here, Ken, where are you from originally and where are you currently?
I grew up in New Jersey, not too far outside of New York City. And I currently live in the San Francisco Bay Area and have for many years. I did an pre-doctoral internship out here in 1986, 87. So it's been a while.
And you stayed?
I stayed. Although it's funny, you come back from the East, you still feel like you're still kind of getting used to being here, but yeah, I stayed.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So how the heck did you get into this field? Let's start there.
This is kind of funny. When I was 8 years old, I decided I was going to be a psychiatrist. Don't ask me how. I had an uncle who was a psychiatrist, great uncle who was a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. So I thought it meant helping people. And I always kind of took to looking after, trying to help out the kids in the classroom that were not necessarily mistreated, but just sort of not kind of neglected, not attended to as much. But in terms of my work years and years ago, even before I was in graduate school, I worked with kids on the autism spectrum and ended up doing a lot of work with kids with severe emotional behavior problems, including ending up as a clinical director of a special ed school serving kids like that.
That was before graduate school.
Before graduate school was some work with the autism, okay. Volunteer, but and then in a residential treatment center, and then afterwards working as well. And in terms of a trauma therapist, I was thinking about this. So I had worked with kids who, many of whom had significant trauma, although I don't think I conceptualized it that way. They were just the kids I worked with and wanted to figure out how to help. It was really more like that. But then more than 10 years, maybe 10 or 12 years into my work, I was working with an adult who I describe in my book some. Her name was Laura. And we had a great rapport, and she wanted to continue to work with me, and I wanted to continue to work with her. And she had history of abuse and a pretty significant emotional, psychological neglect. And I didn't know how to work with the trauma part of it. And I realized I didn't, I thought, and I realized there was a huge gap in my work. And while I initially referred her to EMDR while we still worked, she basically wanted to continue to work with me. So I had to learn. So she basically sent me back to training. So I did some work, some initial training, just the initial coursework in EMDR. I got some training in sensory motor psychotherapy, some other somatic approaches, AEDP, which is an experiential approach, attachment focus. So different things along the way. Currently, I'm getting some training, what's called, and work in what's called DBR, deep brain reorienting. So I've had things along the way, but it was quite a good bit into my work before I actually said, okay, I need to learn about trauma.
So I want to jump back. So you said when you were really young, you had an uncle who was a psychiatrist, but as you got through high school, were you still thinking about becoming a psychiatrist, or had that?
I had always had it in my, well, it wasn't psychiatrist, became psychologist, but always I had it in mind. In college, I studied English, American literature, and history. But it never left my desire to work, you know, in some kind of psychotherapy capacity. And actually, when I was in college studying, I took every psychology of course, psychology of literature, psychology of history. So I was taking a psychology of literature course, and they had us read Freud's interpretation of dreams. So my friend and I, when we were traveling through Europe on a train, he'd wake, he was great with remembering dreams, and I was interpreting dreams. So I would read my book, and then I became a pseudo interpreter of dreams.
Aside from this relative of yours, what do you think it was about you that drew you to doing this?
I think I just, I'm a pretty sensitive and empathic person. I was always drawn a little bit to the underdog, a little bit to the kid who was sort of left out, treated almost like they weren't there. There's something in my heart that was drawn to them. I always loved working with kids. I'm kind of playful and childlike in nature when I'm not, you know, being a serious psychotherapist. I just was drawn to people who needed some help in some way, some care. Right. Even though when I was in college and I studied literature, it was that year I decided I'm going back to studying and becoming a psychologist. And then when I graduated, I worked with kids in a residential treatment center. And these were a lot of kids, significant difficulties developmentally and as well as psychologically. And some of the kids I remember, they said you couldn't work with, but you know, when you're naive and you don't know anything, you just assume you're going to try. And, you know, so that was,
well, let's kind of pause there for a second. Cause I'm curious about your experience walking in there and working with these kids, having had very little experience, correct?
Very little. Yeah.
Okay.
Other than I loved kids.
Okay. So let's dial in. What was that experience like for you?
I loved it. These kids were extremely vulnerable. Some had, you know, what was then called mental retardation, but now called developmental delays. They, not all of them, but many of them were not really wanted. In some cases, not always, by family members. Sometimes they were. I just loved them. I was drawn to them. I enjoyed hanging out with them, playing with them, connecting with them. And there was one boy who was sort of my favorite. And there was I wasn't a psychologist, this was before I went to graduate school, but there was a psychologist that was assigned to the residential unit that I was part of. And he said, "Do you want to work with this kid in therapy?" I'm like, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah." So he was sort of supervising me, and I did play therapy with this boy who was, you know, he was psychotic really, but we connected. And I remember once he would be sort of look like he wasn't processing anything I was saying, right. But I would say things. He had a lot of losses in relation to his family, and it was very painful for him when people left, staff coming and going. And I would say things to him like, "It's so hard when people leave." I would say this and as if he didn't hear anything. I had no idea. Mm. And then at some point after a session, he walks out, he sees a friend from the unit, and this boy is crying because his psychologist, the therapist, is leaving. Oh. And he pats him on the back and he says, "It's hard when people leave." So people get, you get things when you have no idea things are being received and processed.
What's interesting is, okay, so that was before you went to graduate school.
That was before. Just before.
So after you got out of graduate school, I'm curious about where were you working after you got out of graduate school?
I was working in what's called a day treatment program. It was a school-based setting.
Okay.
And I was also working in a different outpatient clinic. The outpatient clinic was more psychoanalytic, psychodynamically oriented. And the school-based setting was just, you know, rough and tumble, you know, kids from all over, kids who were not making it in the school system and need, you know, some who'd gotten in trouble with the law, some who just had significant learning and emotional problems. So I did that for a little bit. And I ended up then in a setting, it was a comprehensive setting. So it had a school setting and it had outpatient therapy. and testing and all that. Initially, I was doing therapy and testing, but they had a school for kids with special needs. And they used to have what they call mild kids with learning issues, but not behavioral problems. And they started having kids more and more behavioral problems. And they asked me to become the clinical director of that program. And so I did that for a good 6+ years before I went into a kind of full-time private practice, mostly initially with kids, later with adults.
How, when you first, when you got out of graduate school and was working with them, I'm curious about how you, quote unquote, work with them and engage with them relative to before you went to graduate school. Now, I ask you that because for some of us, you know, you get out of graduate school, you're ready to go. You've got this degree. You've got all this learning. You're ready to try X, Y, and Z. What was it like for you?
Well, I don't think I ever believed I was ready. I think there's always stuff to learn. I was lucky. I was in an unusual graduate program that really focused on people becoming psychotherapists. So that while I have a PhD and I did research, you know, et cetera, it was focused. It was the program was organized by two women who trained under Fritz Perl. So it was a gestalt, experiential, and body
what program
approach.
Was that?
Then it was Georgia State University. It's not, I think, like that at all now. This was in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
So they were very much about the person of the therapist and your own therapy and your own growth. And when I started working, you know, after that, I worked for a while in the VA as part of an internship. But it's, I think my approach was always to connect in ways that weren't necessarily based on, I was trained in experiential approaches. It's not like I had no theoretical orientation or way of thinking about the work.
Right.
But I think I knew enough what I didn't know, although I've learned more and more how much I don't know. But that I, to me, it was all about connecting. And I learned a long, long time ago that kids, I think this applies to adults too, kids are kids. So it really doesn't matter, you know, what their diagnosis is. The boy I was telling you about, he had all sorts of diagnoses. I told the psychiatrist at the time he's better off drugs than on because he was kind of a zombie. The psychiatrist to retaliate said, okay, I'll take him off all drugs and we could work with him better.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of go with the assumption that you can connect and find a way. I've worked with kids who, were developmentally delayed, very low IQ. Someone said you have to do skills training. You can't do psychotherapy. Not true.
Uh-huh.
If you don't know what you can't, you don't know, then you do it. And then you find out what you can do.
Talk about, let me just remind everyone, I'm speaking with Dr. Ken Benow. The book is called Shame, Pride, and Relational Trauma, Concepts and Psychotherapy. How did this book come about?
No one writes a book about shame or articles about shame without having lived it, as well as wanted to learn to help others with it. So I have a certain kind of sensitivity and introversion and empathy that I think makes me somewhat, quote, shame prone.
Mm-hmm.
And I also learned in my own therapy that I was experiencing shame without knowing it. So I've been in therapy for many years, different kinds of therapy, including psychoanalytic therapy. And I worked with someone whose approach is now called coherence therapy. And it was there that I discovered I was living with shame. I had no idea. I thought it was, I was sad or get a little teary and I didn't know why. In retrospect, I understand it is that I wasn't really being true to myself, which is a form of adaptive shame. I call it good enough me shame. So it's like when you're not being true to your own values. So I would feel that. I would feel the kind of sadness, like a hurt, like I was somehow hurting myself. And but I didn't know that was shame. And then through the work in the therapy, I learned more and more that there are lots of different forms of shame that I was living with, some that I would call more traumatic as opposed to shame as an emotion.
Okay. Wow. This is, you're saying a lot of great stuff here. And I want to make sure we catch it here. Before we move forward here, how do you define shame?
Shame is about valuation or devaluation. It's about a sense of self. It's about a sense of self in relation to other. And it's, if you follow it, it's actually self in relation to other, in relation to self, in relation to other. So it's a lot of, it's almost like a dark hall of mirrors where you're reflecting back your own experience of yourself and others' experience of you. And it's always about a sense of the whole person, whereas guilt tends to be about an action. I regret doing something. And adaptive guilt would be, I regret doing something that hurt you and I want to make a repair. Mm-hmm. Shame is about the whole self. So rather than I did something I regret or did something bad, it's I am bad. Mm. I am worthless. I am unlovable. I am disgusting. I am anything that is encompassing the whole person. Mm-hmm. So metaphorically, I think of it as like a solar eclipse, where S-O-U-L is being eclipsed, whereas the guilt is more like a dark spot on the moon.
I'm just writing that down here. Solar, S-O-U-L, eclipse. And then you talked about adaptive shame. Say more about that.
Yeah, so everyone writes about shame lots of different ways. So one way to think about shame is to divide it into adaptive and maladaptive forms. Most of the forms that I read about are maladaptive. And then you can also divide it in terms of shame as an emotion or emotional processes, which is kind of in the moment or acute. You feel some shame, you feel embarrassed, your head goes down, your face turns red, and it lifts and shifts. Whereas shame is a traumatic state. It's like a flashback, and you can tap into it. And once you're in that state, it takes over the whole person. Mm. And when the person speaks from that place, it's almost like they're telling the same story about themselves over and again. Adaptive shame, I call good enough me shame, kind of as a takeoff of Winnicott's good enough parent. And basically adaptive shame is when I haven't been true to myself. And this person, Laura, that I was telling about earlier, she taught me about all sorts of shame, both maladaptive and adaptive. And she talked about maladaptive in terms of the experience of being crushed, but her adaptive shame was more like, that's not how I want to be in the world. That's not who I am. That's not how I want to represent. So rather than feeling guilty, like I hurt someone else, it's like I hurt myself and I'm not being congruent with my own.
So it sounds like there's sense of self. With adaptive shame, one has a sense of, maybe ownership or authority over it, an ability to modulate it and to work with it.
That's exactly right. It's okay. More regulated, whereas the traumatic, Judith Herman, the traumatologist, called shame states or traumatic shame states, those are highly dysregulated. So I can feel the pain of shame in a good enough me, an adaptive shame, and I can kind of what I call self-right, R-I-G-H-T. I'm self-righting. I'm kind of like, that's not how I want to be. I want to be more like this. So that's fair. That's quite well regulated. And it's important as a therapist to know that, because you don't want to, quote, cure someone of that. You want to sort of validate it. Like, yeah, that is something to feel some shame about, not like you should be ashamed of yourself. And then work with that. The kind of shame people struggle with in as a therapist is the traumatic forms of shame. Mm-hmm. Those are the hardest, because you'd be working with someone who has qualities like this person, Laura, I was telling you about. If you met them, you say, that's a really kind person. That's a sensitive person, very smart, very professionally successful. Had a good marriage, but they felt terrible about themselves. And it didn't kind of jive. It didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like I could tuck them out of it or say, hey, what about this quality or that quality? None of it made a difference. And it had a kind of this quality of a kind of virulence, like it's chronic, it's not changing. And it's that kind of shame that people struggle with. It's that kind of shame that people go to workshops to learn about, or hopefully read my book or books like it, because that doesn't change without understanding trauma and working with trauma and understanding that this kind of shame. And there's two forms of that kind of shame, two forms that I call, you know, this is just how I slice the pie. I don't believe this is reality. I think it's just how I organize the world. And one I call not me shame, which is a quality, an aspect of self but not the whole self. So let's say a person grew up in a violent home, and on some deep level, determined consciously and unconsciously, they would not be violent, that when they experience anger, they got a shame attack. Not always conscious, sometimes conscious. So they would dissociate unconsciously from their anger because it was so associated with violence or abuse. There's another form of shame that I call know me shame, which is like a shame. Someone else who wrote a wonderful article about this, his last name was Willie, W-I-L-L-E. He called it the shame of existing. So these are people often who experience not just abuse, often profound neglect. And neglect, I don't mean necessarily like they didn't have food to eat or shelter. I'm talking about they were failed to be recognized, to be seen, to be validated, to be noticed, to be felt. And so these people have the experience that they didn't exist.
Wow.
And then with that, with implicitly, if you have the pain of that kind of shame, you come to conclude at some point, if I don't exist in anyone else's eyes, there must be a reason I don't exist. And that reason must be I'm not worthy of existing, of being. Okay. Now, no one necessarily has to tell you that for you to have that experience. But that's the most profound form of shame that I would refer to.
Wow. I mean, as you were describing those qualities, my heart sunk. I mean, it's just so intense.
Yes.
So does you talk about in the bio I read your interest in interpersonal trauma. So does this type of intense shame often follow with it from interpersonal trauma?
Well, the always, in my view.
Always.
I mean, there's trauma of all sorts, right? A car accident.
Right.
But that's not relational trauma. Right. Relational trauma is a term that Alan Shore coined. And it's always about relationship with others. But it's also interrelations about self with aspects of self. But yes, in my view, the kinds of trauma I'm talking about is always relational. But it's complicated because when you think about shame, you tend to think about someone shaming another. You little so-and-so, I can't believe it. You're disgusting. Get out of my face. You're right. Worthless. You're just like so-and-so, et cetera. Okay. And so this is what I would call overt, active presence shaming. And that definitely occurs for many people. And by the way, these different subtypes that I'm referring to, you can have all of them. It's not like you say, well, I just have this versus that. But then there's the shame of that I was referring to earlier, which is the shame of not being responded to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The person I was mentioning, Laura, experienced all these different kinds of shame. And one form that she experienced, the know me shame, was that she described growing up her mother, who you sense in retrospect must have been highly dissociated or possibly psychotic or both. And she, my patient, had the experience of being looked through as if she wasn't there. Okay. And it wasn't just her experience or memory as a child, because as an adult, married, her husband met the mother, same experience. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this person loved to fly planes, and in part came to therapy because they were quite anxious about flying planes.
Are you talking about Laura?
Laura. Yeah.
Okay.
Because they had this, it's kind of hard to describe it. It's a fantasy, but it's more visceral than that. And they had this fear that as though they would walk off the wing of a plane and drop. And I thought, oh, you mean drop to your death? No, cease to be. So that experience that they were describing in that way, I realized only years later. I didn't really understand. I mean, I understood what they were saying, kind of, but I only years later recognized that was their experience, as if they ceased to be, right? They were, and now they're no longer, right? So they couldn't count on a sense of self in a reliable way. Mm-hmm. So that's some of how, you know, you kind of along the way, you sort of, like, what's that? And then years later, you kind of keep working it and try to understand.
I mean, with the understanding that everyone is different and each client is different, of course, how do you begin to conceptualize working with someone like this? You know,
Well, two things I want to. Yeah, right. Well, you do like anyone, right? You're there to get to know them and them to get to know you. At the same time, I'm at this point, I have like a sensor up for things related to shame because no one comes to therapy. I have never met anyone who comes to therapy, says I'm here. Well, maybe now that they've seen about it, the book, they say, oh, I get help with shame. But people don't come to therapy for shame. Mm-hmm. They come to therapy for anxiety. They come to therapy for depression. They come to therapy because they get angry or have relationship problems. But I'm always listening without trying to for things that reflect things related to shame. Mm-hmm. I feel bad about myself. I feel inadequate. I never feel like I'm measuring up. Oh, he or she can, but I can't. So there are these, or you just see them kind of drop into a state non-verbally without saying it. So I'm always listening for language that reflects that so that I can, as soon as possible, name it. Some people say don't name shame because that would be shaming. My view, it's like saying, don't name if someone's suicidal, don't name that they're suicidal. The opposite is true. Mm-hmm. It helps actually to have a way to think about it, step back from it just a little, right? Because when you're in a kind of relational trauma, shame state, it's so chronic. You don't take it as anything other than fact, right? Mm-hmm. I'm lazy. Well, you look at how hard they work and as a in their jobs and as a parent, I'm lazy. I'm a scaredy cat. Well, they've done some really fierce, courageous things in their lives, mm-hmm. just in terms of challenging work. So you get these discrepancies and that kind of captures your attention. The other side of it I want to be sure we talk about is pride. Most people in psychotherapy don't talk about pride. And if they do, they don't use that word. They might talk about narcissism, right? The sort of maladaptive pride, hubris, arrogance, pathological narcissism. But there's also adaptive pride. Pierre Janet writes about adaptive pride in his way when he talks about acts of triumph where you struggle to work through traumatic experience and you come through the other side and there's a sense of I did it. That's an adaptive form of pride. And along the way, as I was trying to understand shame in relation to pride, I'm an English major. That's where I was trained initially, way before psychology. I was an English major. So I love words, always love words and word origins. So I looked up the word proud. I want to know what the word origin of proud was. The earliest root of proud is spelled prodesse, I guess, P-R-O-D-E-S-S-E. Okay, it's a Latinate form. P-R-O-D means for, F-O-R. E-S-S-E means to be or being, right? So I thought for being, okay? So it's not the pride of I accomplished something. Mm-hmm. This is the pride of being. It's the opposite of no being. Mm-hmm. This is the pride of being. So when I work with someone, I'm always, and this is part of my training in graduate school, which was always, it was the humanistic approach. So it's always in terms of growth, not just in terms of pathology. So when I'm listening to someone, I'm listening for who they uniquely are. Now, that could be just how they turn their head. It could be something they throw offhand, like kids, you know, a lot of kids or young adults, they love video games. I'm not a fan. But if I'm smart, I say, what video game do you like and why? It's not what you think. It's almost never the shoot 'em up games. One person might be really interested in fantasy because they got a sense of themselves through that fantasy experience. Other people like to build, very creative. They like to build. So I'm looking for the essence of a person. And that's how I came up with the term pro being pride. It's a form of aliveness. And when the person can access their pro being, that's the most powerful antidote to shame, including the traumatic shame states.
Wow. This is like a masterclass in working with shame and pride. It was interesting when I read your bio and pride was in there. I was like, okay, where is this coming from? What is this about?
Yeah. So before I was in graduate school, I abhorred pathologizing. So the kids I worked with had all sorts of diagnoses. They were my quirky kids. That's my diagnosis, quirky kids, lovable quirky kids. So even in graduate school, when I had to take diagnosis, right, DSM, I was like, wanting to figure out any other way to talk about people other than diagnosis. Mm. So when I started, not started for many, many years, became interested in and then reading about and trying to think about with my patients about shame, I thought, what's the opposite of shame? Not everyone agrees, by the way, that the opposite of shame is pride. But I felt like if you're going to study shame, you have to study pride. So I started, there's not much written about it. And truly, of the people who write about shame, I'm the only one I know of who writes about pride in this way, just because it tends not to be the thing people focus on. So for me, I wanted to see, well, what is it that goes into a person feeling good about themselves? How does one experience the pride of accomplishment? But then when I found this pro-Dessa, this pro-being, I thought, that's it. There's something even more profound. This is when a person just has this quality and you kind of like see or feel their light. Okay, I don't know how else to describe it, where you feel their energy. And when I'm in contact with their pro-being, I'm in contact with my own. And I feel it energetically. I feel it tingling sensations, usually in my arms. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon that when I'm having this sensation, the client will say spontaneously, I'm getting this tingling sensation, or I'm feeling my chest opening up, and not in a kind of, you know, bravado kind of way, just in a kind of expansive way. And sometimes they feel a sense of oneness, a sense of greater integration with themselves or the world. And in my book, I document verbatim transcripts of sessions where they begin in traumatic shame states and they move through different processes and they end up with this experience of probing pride and sometimes in this experience of kind of what they call unitive consciousness, kind of like oneness with themselves and the world. Wow. So I don't know if that answered your question.
It does. And I mean, I think we can go on. I certainly can go on for a long time here. I just want to be mindful of the time here. The book again by Dr. Benow is called Shame, Pride, and Relational Trauma, Concepts, and Psychotherapy. Who's the book for, Ken?
It's mostly for therapists. It's okay. Mostly for trauma therapists. I've had surprisingly some quote unquote lay people say they found it really helpful. Because I think what it is I'm describing something that resonates with their own experience. So even if they're not, quote unquote, approaching it as a therapist, just as a human being, it's hard to not experience shame in some way unless you're, you know, people who are lacking in consciences tend not to feel shame. Some people who are more narcissistically oriented tend to not feel shame, but can be driven very much by shame. But it's basically for people who experience shame or who work with people who experience shame, but mostly for therapists and mostly for trauma therapists and mostly for trauma therapists who are interested in shame and pride. So it's, you know, it's a particular group, but more and more people want to learn about it. So if you see workshops with shame, a lot of people sign up because of that.
Right. Well, from what you said here, I think this is invaluable and would be invaluable for any therapist, and more specifically any trauma therapist, to certainly be acquainted with. Ken, what's the best way for people to get in contact with you?
They can Google me. They'll see my phone number there. You can check out my website through Psychology Today. And I also have a special site called ResearchGate, where people who publish kind of post their articles. So in there's several articles I've written about shame and pride. And obviously you can also check out my book. It's published by Routledge, and you can also get it like other places, including Amazon.
Awesome. Well, fascinating. And I have to say, I think you're the first person in all the interviews I've done who really kind of dialed in and got this specific about shame, let alone shame and pride. Awesome. So glad you're here. Love to have you back at a later date. Thank you so much for being here, Ken.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.